Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. Today, Sonny Buxton is my guest. Sonny is a legendary jazz performer, club owner, former professional football player with the Oakland Raiders, and presently host of his weekly Saturday morning radio show on KCSM in San Mateo, California. Here's part one of my conversation with Sonny Buxton. I just want to have you share your comments about jazz, your show. Yep. And I've been reading with interest the club, about your experiences as a club man,
yes,
as well as
yes.
Pearl.
Yes.
I really, really want to just have you, take control and just paint a picture of what that was like. But I first want to start with your magnificent show that is heard every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time on San Francisco's Bay radio station to the world, KCSM. We're streaming kcsm.org. So tell me, Sonny, putting your program together, what can listeners expect each week?
You know, one of the funny things, and maybe sad things at the same time, is that I'm still trying to put on or present the perfect show. And then that means with the perfect balance of music. I try to program some of the traditional music as much as I possibly can. I realize that I can't go back to the 1920s and 1930s and really present something that people are going to sit for. But there should always be some reference to that. And that can be through modern contemporary artists. And I think that there are certain people that we should never forget. Duke Ellington as an example, Art Tatum as another example. And then when you speak of someone like Art Tatum, that's a name that probably is forgotten by a number of people who were never really introduced to Art Tatum. But you hear Art Tatum through just about every contemporary piano player in the world today. And they can't really escape him. You can't escape Duke Ellington. I remember Billy Strayhorn saying years ago that said you really can't do a radio program without Edward, meaning Edward Kennedy Ellington. And that's true. I think there's got to be some reference to people like that in order to succeed. And so I try to mix a little bit of that in one way or the other. And I also try to get a balance of vocalists that count and vocalists that we should never forget, as well as people like that. And also some new artists, as long as it mixes. And if it doesn't mix, I'm only on the air 4 hours a week. So if it doesn't mix, then I don't do it. And I think that's important to balance the program that you're presenting to an audience out there. And also to imagine what they're doing while you're on the air. So if you have a 4 hour shift, if you have a 1 hour shift, what are those listeners up to? And what's going to attract them? And I think that's really important. And also what you can relate to. It would be ludicrous for me to try to present a hip hop show. That's not me. It just isn't. You know, and it could be, but that's not my personality. I think once I open my mouth and speak for about 2 minutes, it's not a revelation that I'm not really a hip hopper. So there's really no point in doing that.
Well, you've spoken with some of the greats that you play on your show, Duke Ellington, for example. Talk about your conversations or memories of speaking with Ellington and other great art presenters that you have run across in your career.
Sure. I had a grant some years back in the 60s to do a 40-year retrospection of Ellington and the person, and Ellington the band leader, and all the other things. So I was fortunate enough to work for an outfit that would allow me to take some time off to join them. The idea was to go on the road with Ellington. And if I could have shut everything down for 6 months, it would have been ideal, but I couldn't do that. So I would go out, I'd meet the band and spend as much time as I possibly could, a couple of days, sometimes maybe even 3 days, get back to Seattle, where I was located at the time, to work and try to put these things together. And Billy Strayhorn is the one who precipitated that and helped us set it up, along with Quincy Jones. And I was trying not to go through management office to get to Duke. And one of the things that was interesting in that excursion with Ellington and the orchestra was that I was out for I don't know how many weeks getting tape and interviewing different people in the orchestra. But Duke didn't really talk to me. He always greeted me, but he did not sit down to talk. So I was beginning to get a little desperate after a couple of months of doing this. And I had no tape of Ellington. Harry Carney, the baritone, great baritone saxophonist who was with the orchestra at the time, was very sympathetic. And so I was talking with him and I was sort of at wit's end. I said, what am I going to do? I'm out here, I'm passing this guy every day and we greet each other. But I don't have any interview tape. And he said, Edward, as he always called him too, he said, he's the premier orchestrator. He's not going to let you come in and dictate how it's going to go and when it's going to go. And I thought, oh man, now what? And he said, he'll talk. He's going to talk with you. He said, now mind you, when he does start talking with you, he's going to lie. He said, Edward is the world's greatest liar. I said, well, how am I supposed to sort that out? He said, he'll come back. He'll come back around with the truth. So that's the way that whole thing started with Ellington. I did get a lot of tape, and I was so impressed with myself, I think, probably more with Sonny than with Ellington. So I got back to Seattle, and I had all this interview tape, and I was putting all this stuff together. And so I sat back one night, and I was just working really, really late into night, and I was listening to this interview stuff, and all of a sudden it hit me, this light went on. I said, he didn't say anything. I have all this tape of Ellington's voice, and he didn't say anything. Ellington was really enamored with the English language. He loved it. He and Billy Strayhorn were very much on the same wavelength for that. And he knew how to use words. He was flattering me, and he was throwing these words around. And so as I began to analyze this whole thing, I said, man, I have all these minutes of the wonderful tape of Ellington, and he didn't say anything. So I still had to put the thing together as it was. And it was a very, very interesting experience for me. And it was a growing up experience too.
And you've spoken to other luminaries.
A number of them. I was a musician too. I was a player for some years as a drummer, and then when I decided to devote most of my time to broadcasting, I thought that I never really lost the desire and the passion for the music, and also one of the things that I had decided to do early on in broadcasting was to not allow myself to be labeled as a jazz announcer. I didn't want that. I was doing a little bit of it here and there, but it was so difficult to break in. It was really difficult to break in, and there were all kinds of walls that were set up, and 1,001 excuses as to why I couldn't be hired. And I thought that's one that I don't need. I don't need this, because a couple of guys that I did interview with said, well, gee, we do a little bit of jazz from midnight to 6 a.m., but could you fit in there? And by the way, you don't have an engineer's license, do you? I said, no, I don't have an engineer's license. Well, we need a combo man, for those hours. But on the jazz, so I kept getting that jazz thing because it was on my resume. And I said, I got to take that off. So I took it off. And then the first program that I had was actually the most successful for about 10 years. It was a country western show. And it was from Bluegrass Pickin', it was called. And it was a history of bluegrass music. And that thing took off. It just took off and went into syndication. And I said, man, I've broken some barriers, but I know I'm identified as a country western guy. So I had to sort of break that mold. And in the meantime, I was studying as much as I could about Euroclassical music. And so this guy that was really assisting me, and he opened up his facilities. This is in Northern California and on the peninsula. And so I would go in, and he would sort of review and critique what I was doing. And he would have me put an hour-long show together, and then he'd sit down and he'd critique it and so on. So he said, "Do you think you're ready to do a classical show?" I said, "I don't know." So I was going back and forth between California and Seattle, and there was an opportunity to station. And it was almost the same excuse. The guy said, "Do you know classical music, European classical music?" And and I hesitated. I said, "Man, if I say yes, then what?" And if but I couldn't say no. I said, "Well." I indicated that I was sort of in between. So they hired me. And boy, and man, that audience chewed me up. Because they wanted it to be exact. Mind you, this is the early years of FM. And a lot of people didn't really know what FM was. It was on their radio. It was attached to their consoles. But it was just there. And so this was just the beginning of commercial FM. And the station that hired me was one of the big flagship stations in Seattle, KING. And they were Channel 5 and television. And they had a very powerful AM station, 50,000 watts. And then they had FM. And so it was mostly simulcast. But they were beginning to break away with their individual shows. And so mine was one of them. And so it was, I was shaky. And so they had me start doing relief with another guy who was far more informed about Euroclassical music. But the audience did, as I was saying a few minutes ago, they just chewed me up because they wanted, if you were doing a French opera, as an example, I would do opera one night and then symphonic music the next night. They wanted the nasal effect. If it was Italian, they wanted staccato, and so on. You know, and man, the pronunciation had to be just so. And if it wasn't, you were going to hear from the phone would ring. So that was the idea. So I learned quite a bit about it, and so it was a challenge. And I said, well, if you're going to be in this business, then that's what you have to do. And well, so I did it. I kept going back, I was like the fighter who got punched in the jaw and knocked down, and I would get up again. I'd bounce up again and then go in for more punishment. But when I finished, I said, "Yeah, I can do that. I can handle that." And that's one down. They can't throw that one in my face anymore. And so then I went to just really popular music and some stuff that was, this was the number one station in town, which was KOMO. And so the hippest thing that I programmed was Dean Martin. Then that's about as hip as I got. And so I did that, and the show worked very well. And then I met a fellow named Gordon Sherwood. He and his partner were radio troubleshooters. And these guys would—they would go onto a station, and they would tear it apart if it was a problem. And at that time, ratings were so important, as they still are today for commercial stations. But and then they would rip it apart and almost rebuild it. So this Gordon Sherwood had heard about me, and I was the only black guy doing what I was doing, and he approached me, and he said, "I have an offer." He said, this is a real challenge. He said, so he said, "I've heard all these things about you, and you're a ball player and you're a musician, all that stuff, you know." So he said, "We found an outlet that there's this one position, AM position on the band that has not been occupied." He said it was something that was overlooked. He said the FCC is looking into it. And he said, "We're gonna try to pick that up." He said, "We're doing all the politicking." And he introduced himself as a troubleshooter. And he said, we work these days. He said, "And we'd like to bring you in." He said, "But we're going to teach you from the ground up." And he said, "We'll pay you." And he said, "Well, probably won't pay you as much as you're earning these days. But He said, if you're game, he said, we'll teach you the business from the ground up. So I really had to think about it, and I still had another season to play ball and so on. So I got back to them, and I thought to myself that this is a golden opportunity. You know, I mean, the chance of me getting on the ground floor of a radio station that is just being constructed signal-wise all the way up to the top where is something that immeasurable and something that I would not be able to duplicate. So I decided to go to work with these guys, and it was a hell of an experience. And so we got the station on the air, and the format was going to be primarily for the African-American audience. But the other thing that these guys were up to was that they realized that the African-American audience in Seattle was a tricky one. You had a number of people who had been there for years. My dad was one of them. And I mean, for a long, long time. And also that the Black population in Seattle hadn't changed for quite some time. And then suddenly there was an explosion. So that population up there went from 18,000 to 50,000 almost overnight. And so a lot of the people that had been pioneering in that city sort of resented the new people who were coming in. There was an acceptance for the professionals coming in, the doctors, lawyers, and some other people, but not so much of an acceptance for some of the other people. And some of them were GIs that were coming in with the GI Bill and going to school. And then there were some people who were just coming in from Louisiana, Mississippi, primarily from Louisiana, some from Texas, and for opportunities to work. And there was a line of demarcation there, and that was the older established Black people in Seattle, and almost against the new people. And if this station was going to succeed, it was going to have to appeal to all of them. And so that was my responsibility. And so that meant I had to get in and do a lot of marketing. And in the meantime, the other thing was to inform people as to what FM was. Because they didn't have a clue in most instances. So we designed these little radios with only that station's signal on it. And so going out to make sales, and I had to make sure that the signal was just right. If I was going into a car dealership, I didn't want to get inside the dealership and try to turn that station on and not be able to find it.
If you are away from your favorite radio station, you can find Like It Is on NV1 app for Apple and Android. My guest is Sonny Buxton. We return to that interview right now.
You are a jazz man, as our listeners will find out. And you had a very interesting quote, and I'm going to get it right here. You said, a story of jazz leads, not follows, the story of integration in this country. Would you elaborate on that a bit more?
Yeah, so I think that's a part of what I was just referring to.
Yes.
You know, it's almost like the chicken and the egg. If you want to trace the history of jazz, you really have to begin to trace the African-American experience. The slave introduction to this country, then the migration. The migration was very important. One small example of that, and this is it's not sidetracking the question too much, but I was working with a band, and I'd been recommended to this band leader, and this is in Long Beach, California. And so every Friday, Saturday night, Black folks there got their paychecks. They worked for Douglas Aircraft and so on, and so they were paid once a week. So it's a big deal, you know, to have those dance blues parties and everything. So this is essentially it's kind of a hip blues band. And so I went to start to work with this guy sort of one Friday night. And so I'm back there playing. And so we took a break. And so that saxophonist, who was the leader of the band, invited me over to the bar. I said, have a drink. I didn't drink alcohol at all in those days. And he says, well, where are you from anyway? So I told him. He said, I know they had any colored people up there. And I said, yeah. So he said, well, look here, man. He said, I hear you back there. And I was struggling to get this thing together. And I couldn't figure out why I was struggling. And he said, look, he said, I don't need all that rat-a-tat stuff. He said, man, just kind of lay it in there. And what he was really referring to was that the rhythm was different. And so that I was playing for a lot of Texas African-Americans who had moved to that Long Beach area, and they were working primarily in those aircraft factories. And they had a certain way of dancing, and they were dancing to a certain beat. And that was part of the migration. So there were a lot of Texas, Louisiana people in Los Angeles at the time. And so the music really followed that. And so if you were going to do it, if it was done properly, you had to really tune in to where those people were. And that's what happened early on with the music from Louisiana, when Louis Armstrong and King Oliver and those guys moved from New Orleans to Chicago. They took the New Orleans sound with them. Duke Ellington had a sophisticated sound coming out of Washington, D.C. And so he took that to New York and then embellished that with some jazz overtures and overtones. And that was the beginning of the Ellington sound, which was different. And then if you compare that to Count Basie coming out of Kansas City, there was a Midwest sound and Midwest rhythm. And that's what Basie was about. Basie's band was about rhythm. Great soloist too, but man, that band was rhythmic. And that's what you had to have if you were going to succeed in that Kansas City, Oklahoma territory area. So that's a part of it. And so I think that each part of the country that you begin to investigate it, as a sociologist, you begin to find if you want to attach music to it, the storyline is almost intricately the same. And the music, if you want to trace it, trace the music, then you're going to trace the migration of African-Americans. And African-Americans have always traditionally brought, I've been teaching recently quite a bit. And so the part of the course that I've been teaching recently was introducing tap to our sociological development. And African-Americans are the ones who created tap. That's strictly an African-American thing, but that also came out of spirituals. That was a part of it. And they were using that as a way of communicating. And they replaced the drums because white slave owners began to get on to the communication level with slaves that they were using drums. So they banned drums, and the slaves began to tap. And so it was the same thing, that they were communicating through their feet. And so that part of what I've been saying to the class that I've been teaching is that you should listen. It's not all about flash, it's about listening. And true tap dancers are tapping out a pretty solid message.
We're in a course today, the master class, and the master is directing and lecturing. Sonny Buxton is my guest. Sonny, that may be a simple question, but I think you're the appropriate person to give answer to it. The most dramatic change you've experienced or seen in jazz today?
I don't know if there's a dramatic change. I wouldn't say that. There's an evolution.
There's
been an evolution of the music. And since I've been involved, when I first became involved with the music, it was through bebop. And that was Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and Thelonious Monk, and those people, Kenny Clarke, the drummer, Max Roach. So that's evolved a little bit, but it hasn't changed that much. It's still rhythmically sound. And also that's the essence of it. You have to start with the rhythm. So I haven't seen a major change there. I've seen the introduction just recently of hip hop with the music. But then again, as I was telling my son some years back, I said, you know, nothing has changed that much. And I introduced him to Louis Jordan. I said, there's your hip hop. I said, Louis Jordan. So that I said, that's early 1940s. So we had that element all the way back at that period of time. And so what they're doing today It's just putting a little bit more icing on the cake, but it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed that much.
That is very interesting. Although I think some people who are more, I guess, steeped in just hip hop 2024 wouldn't see the connection or wouldn't understand that that version of hip hop, as you just explained, has been there all along.
Yeah, it has been there. That and that's just to say that some things remain the same, but we put an icing on it and we keep smoothing it out and working with it. Bebop is still there. It's not quite the same as it was with the early years of Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and that group. And remember that shortly after that, the industry began to put another heading on it. They called it hard bop, and that was Art Blakey primarily, and his style of drumming, and then that evolved. And I was a drummer, so I would listen to all these guys. Roy Haynes was my man, and then I heard Tony Williams, the young drummer who Miles Davis hired at the age of 17. I heard him when he was 18, and I had stopped playing, and then I had come back to playing, and so I laugh about it now. I said, so I went to hear Miles Davis and this new young drummer, and I wasn't a believer. I said, 18 years old, and what the hell could he be saying that's different? And he was different. he was different. I'd heard Elvin Jones with John Coltrane, and then this kid comes along, and he was playing stuff that I couldn't even identify. But still, the foundation was there. It wasn't that far removed from Roy Haynes, who was my man, and Max Roach, but he has just put another layer on it. And so that's the way it's gone. And so we had Jack Dejanet and a few other drummers. But essentially, the drum work from the master class hasn't really changed that much.
Well, I'm going to come back to what we started, and that's your show that is on every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time on KCSM 91.1 and streaming live on kcsm.org. Catch it, listen, and enjoy and become educated, informed, and even more impassioned about jazz music. This was part one of my interview session with Sonny Buxton. We'll continue our sit-down session in 7 days. If you find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many others on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you, and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.